Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, WISO Community Voices producers Amelia Robinson and Kristen Wicker tell us about a knockout charity event, and we'll speak with Megan Cooper of Film Dayton. Juliet Fromholt tells us about an event that's out of this world. Up first on Sochi Talks, Dr. Susan Trollinger is an English teacher at the University of Dayton. For more than 15 years, she's been studying tourism in Amish country. Her new book, Selling the Amish, The Tourism of Nostalgia, features some of her research. Today, she gives us a few highlights.
Given all the media attention that the Amish have received in recent decades, I suspect you know something about them. You probably know that they are a plain people who look like they are still living in the 19th century. They dress in old-fashioned clothes. They farm by horse and plow. They light the night with gas-powered lanterns. And they travel by horse-drawn carriage. You probably also know that they are a deeply religious people. They hold four-hour worship services, and they will never raise a hand against another, even in self-defense, because Jesus said that we should love our enemies. Finally, you probably know that they are a communal people. They show this commitment in their uniform dress, and they cultivate it by refusing insurance, relying on one another for help when needed instead. We all know that no one can survive, never mind flourish, in this high-tech and highly competitive world, who is not plugged in and working all the time. Yet the Amish, who do neither, are not just surviving, they're thriving. Today, there are over 250,000 Amish living in North America. And in just the last 2 years, they increased their numbers by 10%. According to the Young Center at Elizabethtown College, in just 20 years, from 1991 to 2010, the Amish doubled their numbers, and they'll do it again, but next time, in just 15 years. How can such a people who don't even drive a car, never mind get on the information superhighway, be doing so well? This is a fascinating question, and it appears that lots of people are looking for the answer. Every year, 19 million people visit Amish country. 11 million go to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Another 4 million go to northern Indiana, and still another 4 million visit Ohio's Amish country, which is in northeast Ohio, about 50 miles southwest of Akron. Although tourism in all three of these locations is interesting, I focused my research on Ohio's Amish country, which is home to the largest Amish settlement in the world, with over 260 Amish churches and more than 30,000 Amish people. So, 4 million Americans, most of them middle-class Midwesterners, visit Ohio's Amish country every year. And they presumably make the trip because they find these people, who defy all of the wisdom of our culture, fascinating. Yet when they arrive in Amish country, what do they find? They find huge hotels that look like the grand Victorian homes of America's 19th century millionaires. They find gift shops filled with exquisite chocolates, beautiful lace tablecloths and curtains, Oriental-style rugs, and porcelain figurines. In short, they find a style of living that at first blush couldn't be farther from the plain and simple life of the Amish. Despite the fact that tourists apparently aren't getting what they come for in Amish country, millions still make the trip, and many make repeated trips. How can this be? To answer this question, I went to Amish country and watched tourists for about a decade. I watched them and listened to them and sometimes talked with them. I also read a lot about them, and I looked closely at what was being offered to them. I looked at the architecture of the buildings constructed for them and studied the interior decor of those buildings. I studied the merchandise, what was being sold, and how it was displayed. Here is a bit of what I learned. The middle-class Americans who visit Amish country bring with them more than a few questions about the Amish. They come to Amish country with a whole host of concerns about themselves and the world they inhabit. They are concerned about how life is changing and who they are becoming. They have real anxieties about what it means to be a man or a woman in today's world. They struggle with the impact technology is having on their lives, and they worry about time always, there seems to be less and less of it. As I studied what Amish country offers its visitors, I came to understand that it doesn't just give them beautiful buildings, tempting trinkets, and fabulous food. While it does all that, it also invites them to enter a world in which idealized memories from the past are transformed into an image of a future in which all of these anxieties and concerns are beautifully resolved. Let me share with you just one example of how this happens in one of the most popular tourist towns in Ohio's Amish country, Walnut Creek, which is a small town in about the middle of Ohio's Amish country, is home to one of the oldest tourist businesses in Ohio's Amish country, their Dutchman restaurant, which specializes in Amish cooking. If you've ever eaten at an Amish-style restaurant, you know what to expect. Large portions of pan-fried chicken, roast beef, baked ham, and smoked sausage, along with real mashed potatoes, chicken noodles, dressing, or what you might call stuffing, and homemade bread. The meal is typically brought to a delectable finish with a serving of one of many freshly made fruit cream or custard pies. No doubt, lots of people come from miles around to eat this food. But is it only about taste? I think there's more to it than that. The food at Der Dutchman is slow food. It's not the fast food of our freezers and microwaves. It can't be produced, served, and eaten in the 45 minutes between arriving home from work and taking the kids to gymnastics and basketball. This food takes time. To make it requires peeling, chopping, basting, roasting, mashing, rolling, and raising. And at Der Dutchman, all of this work is done on site, and much of it by hand. Moreover, this food is slow, not just in its preparation time, but also in the sense that it takes a lot of time to master the techniques needed to make it. Probably each one of the cooks in Der Dutchman's bakery brings decades of experience in rolling out a flaky pie crust or raising up a chewy cinnamon roll. This food isn't just about taste. It's about time. When a visitor to Amish country has dinner at Der Dutchman or other similar restaurants, they're not just consuming a tasty meal. They're also experiencing an idealized memory of the past. There once was a time, so the memory goes, when families gathered at the dinner table every evening to enjoy a meal that took the better part of a day to make and that was prepared by a woman with decades of know-how. That is, they're experiencing not just happy taste buds, but also a happy image of how people used to live when time was abundant. Importantly, Der Dutchman doesn't only sell hot meals. It also sells all of the baked goods, plus the apple butter, various jams, and pickled vegetables made on site. In addition, Der Dutchman sells its own and other Amish-style cookbooks that instruct readers in how to recreate this slow food at home. Thus, Der Dutchman isn't just giving visitors a trip down memory lane. It's also helping them to imagine a future in which slow food and ample time characterize daily life. So, how do the Amish fit in all of this? Well, of course, it's their cuisine that is being sold. It's also many of their women who cook the food at Der Dutchman. But there's more. I believe that the Amish are crucial not just because their food is featured, but because they embody in really visible ways the notion that it is possible to live differently than most of us do. In a culture that prizes advanced technology and its promises of efficiency, they choose the horse. In a culture that frowns on the fashion of just 6 months ago, they wear the same kinds of clothes they've worn for centuries. In a culture of speed, they are slow. Really slow. If you've ever been caught behind an Amish buggy making its way up one of the beautiful rolling hills of Ohio's Amish country, you know what I mean. The Amish tell us through their food, dress, mode of transportation, and in 100 other ways that we don't have to live as we do. They don't. And that means we don't. Amish country tourism promises that if you buy that loaf of bread or pie or cookbook, you can refashion your life. You can experience a slower pace. Moreover, it makes that promise in the context of the largest Amish settlement in the world. While tourists are hearing that they can slow down, they are also seeing the Amish who have done just that. What is so fun about touring Amish country is that the Amish make the promises of Amish country tourism seem real. Buy this cookbook and you really can change your life. Importantly, In order for the Amish to make these promises seem viable, the Amish have to be, well, Amish, which is to say, strange. And as they pull their steel-wheeled hay balers through their fields, or walk about town in their long-sleeved dresses and black stockings on hot summer afternoons, or spend the better part of the day just driving home from the store, they also pose a question. To tourists who want more time, they ask, are you up to it? The Amish show visitors that it can be done. That's the fun part of visiting Amish country. But they also show visitors that to do it requires a lot more than a loaf of bread, a pie, or a cookbook. Are visitors to Amish country willing to make the changes that they would have to make to really slow down the pace of life? That's a great question. Studying tourism in Amish country has helped me ask questions like these of myself. If you haven't been to Amish country, I hope you'll go. If you have been there before, I hope you'll go again. Either way, I hope you will listen carefully and consider seriously the questions that Amish life poses to folks like you and me. Thank you.
Dr. Susan Trollinger, her new book is Selling the Amish, the Tourism of Nostalgia. So She Talks is a program designed to enlighten the world with knowledge from primarily institutions of higher education in Southwest Ohio. You're listening to WISO Weekend on WYSO. Last November, Megan Cooper signed on as executive director of Film Dayton. I spoke with her about her first few months on the job and what's happening with the organization.
It's been fantastic. I mean, it really opened my eyes. I knew that we had a really strong and solid arts community in the region, and I knew that film was a part of that. But just every single day, learning about the vast amounts of talent and working professionals in the region and the really impressive projects that they're working on, everything from shorts to features, documentaries and narratives and new media as an art form. There's really so much happening, and it's both in our region and it's people from our region who are going elsewhere and making big names for themselves, doing really impressive things.
And you're conducting workshops.
There's a lot going on with education. Really, we've got two levels of educational opportunities. One is introducing filmmaking to students, and that's usually through school programs or community centers. And what happens with that is professional filmmakers come in and they lead a workshop or camps that teach students all the skills that they need to be their own filmmaker. The coming up with the story, the working with the cameras, the editing. And what's very cool about this is that the skills are important, but the camps are more than about sparking an interest in filmmaking as a career, because the students take away lessons on how to communicate their story, creative thinking, collaboration, and really some of those intangibles that are important for whatever field they pursue.
And you've got some experts in the filmmaking field coming in to help educate.
We do. It's really impressive. The people who are working professionals both here in our region, or they're from our region and they go elsewhere. And the other thing that we want to do is really our second level of educational opportunities, and that's about professional development. It goes back to the fact that we've got a great talent base here in the region. And so what Film Dayton strives to do is raise the bar for the quality filmmaking that's happening by providing our professionals with opportunities here in their own backyard. And that's what we have coming up at the location workshop next weekend. We're welcoming Kate Amer. She's a production and location manager. She's got over 25 years of experience in the industry, and she really knows her stuff. Recently, she's worked on The Avengers, Journey 2, and Justified, the show that's on FX. A search on IMDb will show you just how much she's done, but it's really important that Kate is coming down for this because, like a lot of other industries, it's both what you know and who you know, and we're really glad that Kate will be leading this workshop and getting to know our talented crew here. It'll be on Saturday, February 25th, and the information for the workshop is online at filmdayton.com. Location is really a big deal in filmmaking. There are questions like, what makes a good location? How do you snap the best picture? How do you handle the production logistics and get all the required permissions that you need? And a lot of the filmmakers in our region may not have an experienced location scout or manager on their team. So this is the opportunity to learn not just the big picture skills, like finding the right location, but all the details that go with it, like location contracts and insurance, permits, working with the homeowners or businesses, and all the responsibilities before, during, and after the shoot.
Well, speaking of location, I know there has been for several years now, I think, a movement to get the film industry to pay attention to Ohio. How are those efforts proceeding?
That is exciting, and it's going really, really well right now. A few years back, in collaboration with our partners throughout the state, Film Dayton and some of our members helped craft and provided input on legislation that allowed a tax incentive for filmmaking to be happening here in the region. It's both a generous tax incentive, but it's also a really logical one because it's about reimbursement of the money that is spent putting our Ohio filmmakers to work. Because when a production comes to town, it's not only the filmmakers who work, but the hotels are filled, the restaurants are busy, and lots of good things happen in the community, and that's what we're fostering. People from Dayton have worked on The Avengers, on Take Shelter, on Ides of March, and there's more and more that is consistently coming because people are taking a look and saying, Ohio has everything we need. We have the really talented cast and crew base, so they don't have to fly people in. We've got varied locations, pretty much anything you would need, with the exception of mountains and deserts. We really can't do that, but we can do pretty much everything else. And all of the resources, the lights and the cameras and the construction companies, because film is more than just about the person holding the camera. It's also about the huge collaboration that goes into it to get it done. And we have the talented people here to do it. And people are taking notice, and it's really being successful for our community, both Ohio and Dayton.
Great. That is exciting news. You've got the workshop on February 25th and February 26th, the Oscar party.
Yes, the Oscar party. It is on Sunday, February 26th, and this goes back to what we try to do to celebrate film in the community and have a great time with our filmmakers and our fans. It's going to be a casual and fun event at G's Grill and Pub. G's is at 5841 Far Hills Avenue, behind the Caribou Coffee there. People can find the directions on our website. And the Oscar party, like I said, it's going to be a casual time. We're going to provide the food, the bar will be serving, and we're going to watch the Oscars on 14 flat-screen TVs, have a silent auction going, and good times with Oscar bingo. And people can also turn in their ballots to win prizes and some bragging rights for the best picks. Because the party's really just about bringing together filmmakers, fans, and friends to have a good time, and it is a fundraiser for Film Dayton.
Megan Cooper, Executive Director with Film Dayton. Megan, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks, Jerry.
Dayton Knockout, a first-time charity event and VIP Fight Night, takes place next weekend, Saturday, February 25th, at Memorial Hall. More than a dozen people who love the Dayton community have been beating each other up at Drake's downtown gym to support Dayton History and AIDS Resource Center, Ohio. WISO Community Voices producers Amelia Robinson and Kristen Wicker report.
Power shots!
The punches are flying as part of Dayton Knockout, a first-time charity event to be held February 25th at Memorial Hall. Maha Kashani of Cincinnati Bell, and also a writer for the Dayton City Paper, will be squaring up against one of her best girlfriends, Shannon Potts, an attorney with the City of Dayton. In this event, friends have had to learn how to punch each other in the face.
Kind of trying to get a hang of it and go, and I actually got one clean hit on her, and I felt so bad, and I just started apologizing, and they're like, no, don't apologize, that's what you're supposed to do. I'm like, I know, but you know, she's one of my best friends, and we're going to be fighting each other, I have to get used to it. The first time I connected, I kind of felt really bad.
Most of the fighters have never been in a rumble before, except for maybe a slap fight here or there. So how does it feel to get punched in the face for the very first time?
It's not fun to get hit in the face, so you just have to up your game. My eyes water a lot.
Getting punched in the face during practice created a challenge for local makeup artist Michelle Richardson.
I actually had an event Saturday night, and it was a lot of eye drops and concealer. If I like break my nose, it's kind of a problem for my profession. I don't really like hitting people. I'd never hit anybody until I did this. Never in a fight, never been hit. When you're doing the training, you're really practicing on the form and, you know, moving away. And then when you get in there with somebody who wants to hit you, it's kind of like, what do I do? It's definitely a learning process to gather yourself together, think clearly, and not get overwhelmed, because as soon as you get overwhelmed, you forget what you're doing, you drop your hands, and you get hit in the face.
This has been a longtime dream of John Drake, the owner of Drake's Downtown Gym.
It's going to be, I think, an event in the middle of a pretty crummy time of year. Super Bowl's over, March Madness hasn't started, everybody's tired of winter, wants something fun to do. We're old school. Everybody is welcome in here. They always have been. You are not judged by what you wear or how you do it, just that you do it and how hard you work. And that's really what my whole business has been based on. You know, more of a, I wanted this kind of a gym. I didn't want a fancy kind of a place, and I wanted boxing.
People can expect a real fight or a bunch of goofballs up here fighting.
No, I think that people will be really surprised. Number one, by the fact that you guys just have the chutzpah to get in there and do this, because most people don't, quite frankly. I'm not going to start naming names, but a lot of people in the media I talk to wouldn't even talk to me about it, avoided me, friends of mine.
It's like a ragtag group, really, not like athletes or anything. Like, what has it been like to train this particular group?
It's been a challenge.
I like to dress up. I love fashion. I'm always wearing high heels. I think the first time John saw me, he kind of looked me up and down and was like, are you serious? This girl is going to come in here and try to fight, and kind of gave me that, are you sure you think you can do this? It's going to be really hard work. You're going to have, you know, you're fighting. I'm like, no, I think I can do it. I think that people are going to be really interested to see somebody like me in the ring for all the different things that I do. I've never done anything like this.
This has been the real deal Holyfield for these amateur boxers, regular people, who have spent about 3 months training for this charity event.
We're trying to speed up this whole training process where people take 6 months to a year before they might spar, and you get comfortable doing things. You've got to move when you box, and it's very difficult. This is what's happening when you're sparring. Nobody is really kind of going, moving back and moving, using the entire ring. You're going to have about 16 and a half feet square, but I could probably have a ring that was 5 foot square. You just have this little room and you'd be fine. You're just kind of like scooting around like a man and woman on the top of a wedding cake, you know, really close together. So one of the things we're going to work on tonight is you guys like coming out of your corner, touching gloves, getting in your stance and relaxing. You know you're going to get hit. If you could stay under control with your hands up and balance and did nothing more than just threw straight jabs, you would be fine.
The boxers that Kristen and I spoke with said that the blood, sweat, and occasional black eye have been wholly worth the effort.
A great cause. You know, I've lived and worked downtown for 6 years, and I've never been inside Memorial Hall, and I'm really excited that they're putting it back into use for these purposes.
Jen Dean of Dayton History and Jack Omer of AIDS Resource Center Ohio gave us a sneak preview of what it's going to look like on fight night.
So this is where they're going to have the betting booths and the bar?
Yeah, this is each end will be a charity betting, and in the middle it'll be a bar.
Okay. Try to keep the flow moving so people can come in here and get drinks, and then get your drinks and walk right by the charity betting.
So where's the boxing ring going to be?
On the stage.
Oh, wow.
It'll be roughly 8 bouts, 360-second rounds, and it's going to be more exhibition. The VIP fighters showing what they've learned at Drake's Gym, all the hard work and the training.
Dean says this is truly a unique event, as there's no other one like it in the state, and the only one she's found in the country is run by boxing great Muhammad Ali and supports Parkinson. She says this is a great opportunity to reintroduce a great facility to the Dayton community.
There's been some gospel concerts, small things, but the last show that the public was invited in to buy tickets and see here was Bill Cosby in 2003.
Jack Omer promises an event that's well worth the money.
The purpose of this event is to attract a new demographic to the fundraising arena.
Dayton Knockout takes place February 25th, which is a Saturday, beginning at 8 p.m. at Memorial Hall.
Visit www.daytonknockout.com to purchase your tickets, find out more information about the event, view photos of the fighters, and more. Reporting for the Community Voices Radio Project at WYSO 91.3 FM, this is Kristen Wicker and Amelia Robinson, Foes in the Ring and Friends, bringing you news about our community.
You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. Also next Saturday, the 25th, the Springfield Symphony Orchestra will present Out of This World, a multimedia concert featuring Gustav Holst's The Planets, set to NASA space images compiled by Wittenberg astronomy professor Dr. Daniel Fleisch. WISO's Juliet Fromholt spoke with Dr. Fleisch about his role in the show. She began by asking him how he got involved with the project.
It has been a long time since David and Peter and some others approached me and said, would you be able to provide some images that we could show during the playing of The Planets? This is done sometimes. I've heard of other symphonies doing this, and it tends to be during the Jupiter movement they show Jupiter, and during the Saturn movement they show Saturn. And the movements are 6 or 8 minutes long, and that's a long time to look at any given planet. So we talked about coming up with some alternatives of things that might be a little more visually interesting. Not that the music needs anything else. I think the music itself is interesting enough. But it is nice, since we do have these fabulous images that our tax dollars have paid for from NASA. It's really nice that we can see those while the music is playing.
And how do you narrow down between all these beautiful images? I mean, what was your criteria for picking them?
Well, so I should say, we decided not to just show Jupiter during Jupiter and Saturn during Saturn. We're telling the life history of stars, because planets and moons come along when stars are born. Stars are born, they live, and they die, and then they seed the space around them with the next generation, the material for the next generation of stars. So we're going to tell that story. So I first of all said, okay, what images do I need to tell about the dying of stars, about the living of stars, about the next generation? So I had a thread that I tried to keep with. And I looked for things that told the story that I was after, but in a rather different way. That is, ones that weren't necessarily the ones that are out there that NASA always shows when they, they have an anniversary of the Hubble or something. They've got a set of images they like to show for that. I used some of those, but I also went for ones that were a little less well-known.
And as far as telling that story, having mm-hmm. that thread, how did you then match the arc, if you will, of your story to the music?
That was a problem. Because the music starts out, the way Holst wrote it, is starting out with Mars. He does not go sequentially from the sun outward in planets. He started with Mars, the bringer of war. This is a theme that a lot of people will recognize. It's often used in science fiction movies. But it's very intense and very dramatic. And if I was going to start with these gas clouds drifting lazily in space, that didn't really fit. But then, and I was struggling with this for weeks, then finally I had an idea that since it's a cycle of star life, star death, star birth, rebirth, since it's a cycle, you can enter that cycle anywhere. So what I thought is, okay, since the Mars movement is first and it's very dramatic and very intense, I'll do the death of the previous generation of stars during that. Once that fell into place, the others just came right as they needed to.
When you listen to The Planets, mm-hmm. it's got a very mystical quality
it does.
To it as well. How do you think the imagery works with the music and sort of expressing sort of the mysticism of space and our fascination with it?
Almost perfectly. As you probably know, Holst was not writing a literal description of Mars when he wrote the Mars movement or Jupiter. First of all, we didn't have spacecraft images in those days. And while Earthbound telescopes can take reasonably good pictures of, say, Jupiter or Saturn or Mars, some of the other planets look like little dots, even in the really big telescopes. And now we think of Neptune as a big blue sphere, or Saturn's rings. We know all the details. That wasn't true in the 19-teens when Holst was writing this. So he wasn't trying to depict the planets literally. Everything I've read about Holst, which is not a great deal, but I did my research before I did anything on this project, and everything I read about Holst indicated he was just trying to do exactly what you said, trying to convey the mysticism and wonder of the universe through music. He was not trying to say Jupiter's theme will sound like this. So that gave me carte blanche. I figured, okay, once he was trying to communicate the mystery and wonder of space, that means I can find images that fit the music and fit within that thread. And I think we've been successful, but I guess it's going to be up to the audience to judge that.
Thank you so much.
Very happy to help.
WISO's Juliet Fromholt speaking with Wittenberg astronomy professor Dr. Daniel Fleisch. The Springfield Symphony Orchestra will perform The Planets as part of their Out of This World concert Saturday, February 25th at Kuss Auditorium. For more from Dr. Fleisch and an interview with a member of the Springfield Symphony Orchestra, visit our website at wyso.org. That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend, but before we go, here's Sarah Buckingham with a preview of tonight's Sunday Documentary Hour.
For much of the 20th century, African Americans in the South were barred from the voting booth, sent to the back of the bus, and walled off from many of the rights they deserved as American citizens. Until well into the 1960s, segregation was legal. The system was called Jim Crow. Tonight's documentary, Remembering Jim Crow, examines the neglected middle years of America's segregation story through the voices of people who lived through it. We'll hear stories about African Americans who found subtle ways to combat the humiliation and economic hardship imposed by Jim Crow, and who built vital social institutions to fight segregation and uplift the race. But in the southwestern Louisiana town of New Iberia, older whites say race relations were more peaceful during Jim Crow than they are now. Tonight's documentary draws on original fieldwork and interviews conducted by the Behind the Veil Oral History Project at Duke University's Center for Documentary Studies. Remembering Jim Crow from American Radio Works, tonight at 6 and 11 p.m. on the Sunday Documentary Hour.
This edition of WISO Weekend on WYSO was produced with assistance from Kara Spray and Aaron Potts. Coming up next on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, The Book Nook.